Welcome to GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. We are recording a hashtag postdocs talk episode today, and Carly and I are your hosts, Carly Sharon, Emily Hutchinson, and we are approaching the end of our PhDs. Carly, have you thought at all about getting a postdoc, or is that something you want to do?
I have absolutely not thought about it. I don't really know what I want to do yet. Maybe a postdoc in my future. I don't know. I still need to sort that out. What about you?
I can see it approaching on the horizon, but I haven't done any work to try and figure it out. So it's great to actually talk to people who are in their postdoc, because that can start the gears turning for coming on. So welcome back to the show, Ariel Frame. You were the managing editor of GradCast for many years.
That's right.
Can you tell us what happened to you after you left GradCast and you went to your postdoc?
I was miserable. I haven't been podcasting. I've been going through withdrawal, if I'm being honest. I stepped down from the managing editor position so that I could finish my PhD. because, you know, it takes some effort to do both managing the podcast and defending a PhD.
Yes,
so I thought I'd focus on one at a time for a minute and then finish it up. So I finished up my PhD last July. And right as I was getting towards the end, while I was getting ready to defend as well, I mean, actually, once you've sort of written the thesis, you've got a little bit of time to, like, think about it. But actually, it was, like, for some years beforehand that I was looking into postdoc positions. Mm-hmm. But it was right at the end there that I was, like, finalizing them, partly because I wanted to, but partly because my partner, now wife, was anxious about what we're doing next. So I was like, I really got to get on this for their sake and for my sake. So I, you know, did interviews and whatnot. And then I managed to get a position in Sheffield, University of Sheffield, in the UK.
Oh, wow.
And he had offered me the position starting October 2023. Mm-hmm. Now, if you notice, I'm not in Sheffield, UK right now. So what happened? My wife is a social worker, and she'd finished her bachelor's here at King's, which is affiliated with Western. So she has a degree from Western, and her degree is recognized in the UK, so she could practice social work there. But she wants to get a master's so that she can get paid a bit more and do some, like, extra things, social worky things that people with bachelors can't do. So she applied to places in the UK and here and got into a couple places in the UK. But the international tuition was out of this world. We would have had to get a $100,000 loan. In fact, the bank, like, laughed me out the door. So we couldn't afford to do it. And to make it work, she could do a program here that was only a year. That's like less than a year, 10 months. So I thought, all right, well, swing for the stars. Let's see what happens. I go back to my supervisor-to-be in the UK, and I say, hey, can you postpone for a year while my wife gets her master's here? And he thought about it for a bit and said, yeah. I was like, okay, cool. Okay, I was like, well, what do I do in the meantime? Well, I can tell you a bit more of the story, how I got the position, but right now I am working for Jane Rylett at Robarts Research Institute here at Western, and she agreed very generously to take me on a brief postdoc, like a one-year contract. So now I'm just doing this kind of rapid fire postdoc. It's very difficult to get anything done in only 1 year, but I'm rapidly trying to do some sciencing before we go in July. So that's what I've been doing. Rapid sciencing at Robarts, getting married, finishing my PhD, and postdocing, so to speak. That's what I've been doing since GradCast. But unfortunately, the most difficult thing is that I haven't been podcasting, which I've wanted to, but I haven't. But maybe one day this will, like, ease me back in. That's what I've been doing.
Wow, that's a lot going on. I feel like you might not have been able to fit podcasting in with your
schedule. I mean, when I say it all in, like, one breath like that, then maybe it does sound like a lot. I mean, certainly I have time. Honestly, this is something, like, when we're thinking about career trajectory, and, like, that's, like, a lot what we're going to talk about today, right? So I'm 34, and when I started the PhD, I was 26. There's a number of people who started much younger. So already when I started, I was like, like I'm actually a bit older than the other people. So like, where did I get delayed? What happened to me? Why am I so slow? I mean, it could be slower. I know people who like, even come back, like the people in their 40s and 50s and 60s. And so it's like never too late, really, if you really are passionate about it and it's worth it for you, then I'd say like, you know, graduate school is an excellent idea. Go ahead. But, you know, if I really want to be on this career trajectory where I want to, like, do research in academia, some sort of thing, then, like, you know, time's ticking. It gets a bit difficult, right? So I think there's a number of reasons why I have been a little bit of on a delayed trajectory. But part of it has been every step of the way, I'm not really being willing to break my back over the work. I put hours in, and like a lot will say like, oh man, you're spending like all nighters in this, but usually that's because I've designed the experiment that way. And it might be that I do like a week of like intense 12, 13, 14, 20 hour, whatever hour days, like especially when you're working with live animals. If anyone remembers my previous episodes, like working with mice, working with flies, you're beholden to the life cycle of that animal, whatever it is, or organism. Even if you work with plants, I mean, it can be time sensitive, this stuff. So I will do what I need to do for the science, but then like I take the time to do whatever else what I want to do, including like GradCast, which I see as like kind of like a fun thing for me, and social, and I've done that all throughout. So I did that through my undergrad. It took a little bit of extra time, and I did that in my PhD as well. Not that I wasn't like being as productive as I can. Not to mention, I also was delayed in between my bachelor's and my PhD. Didn't get a master's, started as a master's and rolled over because I was stuck on like, I don't want to leave Vancouver. I'm going to get a position here in Vancouver. And I kept volunteering with labs that were like stringing me along and then being like, actually, we don't have space. We don't have money. So like I spent 3 years doing like when I could have basically been almost done a PhD if I had just like broadened the horizon. So like on the recommendation of my supervisor, multiple mentors at UBC at the time, two things. They said, if you want to work at UBC as a professor, probably don't want to get your PhD here. Two, like, you can't just be lingering all the time if you want to. You're like, this is cool that you're here and participating in the neuroscience community here, but like, you know, if you really want to get a position, you got to like, you know, see other options. So when I interviewed out here, I got offers at Ottawa and McGill and here, and I chose here because I don't know, just I liked it, and I liked the supervisor, and it all kind of like culmination of things. So that is why I'm sort of delayed at the moment. But your question, I mean, I can speak more about this particular point in time, regardless of what age you are, like postdocing and looking for postdocs. Shoot, let me know what you want to know.
Maybe just for background, because you talked about mice and flies and being in the lab and all-night experiments, could you tell us a little bit about what you're actually researching? Because that will kind of fit into what the rest of your life is
like. We have time to get meta after, right?
Yes.
Okay, so very briefly, my PhD was about aging, brain metabolism, and memory. So I was genetically modifying flies and mice to see if the metabolic change had an impact on their cognitive ability across their age. Now I'm working in my work with, that was with Robert Cumming and Anne Simon in the biology department, and now I'm working with Jane Rylette, who studies Alzheimer's disease, and she studies it from various perspectives, including looking at certain types of neurons in the brain that release acetylcholine that are susceptible to damage in Alzheimer's disease. I bring that up because that's what she's kind of famous for and what a lot of people study, but I'm not studying that in her lab. Another thing that's really important for Alzheimer's and something that Jane Rylette's lab works on is apolipoprotein E. And this is a gene that a lot of people have heard of called ApoE, ApoE. Status, you can get your results of whatever your genetic makeup is from 23andMe, or many genetic tests will do it for you. You have to like sign a thing that says you're not going to like have a conniption if you find out that you were actually higher susceptibility, because you actually can determine that. So there is three versions, most common versions. The most common version is the E3. And if you have that, that's your like baseline. That's the typical risk of Alzheimer's, and it isn't low, actually. For like a good portion of people over the age of 80 have Alzheimer's disease. It's the most common neurodegenerative disease that develops with age. But even that risk, whatever it is, it's four times higher if you have one copy of E4.
Okay.
So it's like that's like the worst risk factor that we know of that's been identified by looking at like huge populations of people. And then if you have two copies, you have 12 more than 12 times risk of getting Alzheimer's. So back to my mice, what am I doing about this? You can study it, but how?
Yeah.
So we've taken these mice where we've humanized this apolipoprotein E gene, so they have the human version. So mice don't get Alzheimer's, so we have to genetically modify them to like show some sort of Alzheimer's like pathology. I'm being very careful about that terminology because people say that Alzheimer's mouse, that mice don't actually get Alzheimer's per se, and even if they get Alzheimer's like pathology, is it exactly Alzheimer's? It's a lot of nuance there, so I'm going to say Alzheimer's like pathology. They are more likely to get Alzheimer's-like pathology if they have more like human-like things happening in their brain. Mm-hmm. So we've humanized three different genes. One is that apolipoprotein E, and my experimental condition is the E4, which should be at more risk of Alzheimer's-like pathology compared to the E3. And then two other genes, amyloid precursor protein, APP, and tau, which is a microtubule-associated protein. So that's this little protein that binds the like kind of skeleton of cells, and it holds it together. What amyloid precursor protein does normally is widely debated. I'm convinced that it's some sort of immune function, antimicrobial peptide, a lot of other things going on. The reason we chose these three genes, and actually I didn't develop the mice, it was a combination of labs that had these genetically modified mice each individually, and then they kind of bred them together to make a mouse that has all three.
Okay.
The APP and tau genes they encode a protein. So like they have the instructions to produce a protein that builds up in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. So we don't know whether those are the cause of the disease, like the dying of the neurons in the brain, or is it like the outcome of the dying of the neurons originally? Mm-hmm. But whatever it is, it's what defines Alzheimer's. If you see these things build up in the brain, then it's Alzheimer's. So we made them human-like so that like if there's something Alzheimer's-y is happening in the brains of these mice, we might see it in these proteins building up because now they have those proteins humanized versions of them. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we have three humanized genes. Humanized version of like Alzheimer's humanized mouse with three different genes, and then I added another piece in, and I disrupted their sleep, or I'm disrupting their sleep,
okay.
And that's because sleep disruptions are associated with increased risk of Alzheimer's, and it's actually like bidirectional. So when you get Alzheimer's, you then also causes worse sleep disruption. So like this is all like, if you know anybody in your family, and you're very likely to know somebody, even if you either know somebody who knows somebody or you know somebody directly who has Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. once it hits, you kind of got like a 10-year window. And once it starts really developing, like noticeably, like they're asking you questions again, but like they can't hold a conversation properly, or especially if they can't like do like daily activities in their life, like carry things, do shopping or whatever, then it starts declining very rapidly. And I mean, I don't know exactly how it develops that rapidly, but it makes sense that you have a bunch of these things that are like feed forward.
Yeah.
So like it's causing something that then exacerbates it.
Nice.
So that is very long-winded way of saying what I study. I'm sorry for like making that long-winded, but hopefully I packed in a lot of really important details of my study in that time.
Yeah, sure. Definitely covered a lot. I'm curious. So you said you're looking at these three proteins and you're looking at Alzheimer's pathologies in these mice. Are you just looking at like the buildup of those proteins, or what other kind of characteristics are you looking at in the mice?
So as like as thorough as I was also super simplifying like everything along the way. So you got the broad picture, but what am I actually doing? Like I didn't even tell you what I'm doing with the mice after, right? So I'm taking the brains out of these mice and I'm going to freeze them and slice them into thin little slices that I can then put on proteins that are going to light up and fluoresce where certain markers are. So I want to look for little markers of both these Alzheimer's like the like hallmark pathologies. Mm-hmm. So that's the pathologies developed from that APP gene, amyloid precursor protein. When it's developed pathologically, it produces a protein called amyloid beta. That's yes. from when that APP is snipped in two different spots, produces this amyloid beta. And then the tau protein is actually when it's another little modification is added to it called phosphorylation. So you've got a little modification. It causes it kind of like detach from the skeleton thing that I said it was doing. Mm-hmm. And then it like builds up as well. So those two okay. things will build up. But I'm looking at very, very young mice. Remember I said I only have a year. Yeah. So there's reason to believe that, like, you know, this is a progressive disease. There's a lot of things happening over a very, very long time. And if you have this genetic susceptibility, you have it from birth. Okay. So you could have very small things happening mm-hmm. right from the beginning. So I'm actually looking at really young mice and seeing very subtle changes. So I'm gonna try and light up in the brain fluorescently where these, you know, amyloid beta and tau are, mm-hmm. And see if they're like located in the wrong places or like increased to some extent. Okay. But I'm not expecting to see any like actual hallmark pathology, which is like dead neurons and sticky bundles of things, which we call plaques. Yeah. So I'm not expecting to see any of that. But that's like the simple stuff. I was also like kind of like, I think my basic kind of speculation, but kind of informed based on all the literature that I've read, is that before you have dying, whatever you have like a whole like, before the like fire alarms going off, there's wonky stuff happening. Mm-hmm. There's like, you know, like let's say you had like a building and it's like a business with a bunch of business happening in the building. And you're like, you look at the building and at the beginning, everything's like running perfectly fine. And at the end, when Alzheimer's kicks in, the fire alarms are going off. Buildings are like floors are like breaking out. Doors are falling over and like everything's in shambles and there's fires breaking out all over the place. So that'd be like the end stage. And like when you actually arrive at looking at the dead building, it's like crusty and like there's like burnt marks, right? So it's hard to tell like what actually happened along the way. I suspect there's like some workers that are like not working properly and like maybe some detection stuff, like maybe there was like one fire alarm going off in a hallway that like nobody was dealing with, so there's like maybe there's electrical issues as well. That's actually like very apt because it's like electrical signal in the brain. So I think there's like some small things I can detect that are happening. Mm-hmm. It might be exacerbated by like this sleep problem. So I'm looking at like what I'm thinking is like kind of like normal functioning of the cells in the brain, and kind of looking to detect those kind of some proteins that are involved in that normal functioning and see if they're like being mislocalized in ways that they shouldn't be,
okay.
or just differently from normal in any sort of way, because there's a whole progression that could be happening. Mm-hmm. But any difference I can see that might give us a hint is mm-hmm. like, is this something like bad that's happening that's going to progress into the dysfunction that might lead to damage?
Yeah.
Or is this something that like when switched to this way, it'd be fine, but now leaves you susceptible. So then when the damage comes, you can't deal with it. Mm-hmm. So I'm just looking for kind of like early changes that we can detect. And this is really valuable potentially on the end point, that if you're actually able to detect that in humans, I mean, that's what people want. Mm-hmm. Some people, the reason some people don't want to know their E4 status because there's nothing they can do.
Yeah.
So if we had some answers about like really early, is there something you can do, then there would be a good advice to like go and get that checked. I mean, some would say we actually know a little bit about that, like get better sleep, eat better, exercise, but I think this, you got to personalize it, so it's like not quite clear. So it's not, I don't think it's, I personally, I think it's a great idea to find out your status if you do have E4, that if that's the impetus you need to change. Like if you're already like a super health guru, then like you're not going to change anything. You're doing your best anyway.
Yeah.
But if you're not, but you're like deciding whether I should or shouldn't, then.
Or if you're the kind of person who'd stress out if they don't sleep well, that might not be good. Because you're like, I must sleep. And then you're like, uh-oh.
That would be me. Yeah. 100%. I will not do 23andMe because if I found out I was susceptible for anything, I would just like become paranoid.
Yeah. You might want like a meditation app first. And then like once you got a good.
Get that under control.
Chilling mind first. And then maybe like debate. But,
do you know what E protein you have?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm E3 homozygous, which means I have both copies of the normal one. I don't have increased susceptibility.
You're in the clear. Nice.
What he could have, what I didn't mention, was E2. I was like, wait, what, E2? I said there was three copies. I never mentioned anything about E2. E2 is even rarer than E3 and E4. It's like way, way rare. If you have E2, your lower likelihood of having Alzheimer's. This is more feeding into why this gene is like specifically important for Alzheimer's. Mm. Is even there's another version that makes you lower likelihood of getting Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
E2 is not checked by 23andMe, where I got my results. So maybe I'm E2. I mean, I don't suspect that I'm E2.
You're superior and have the E2.
No,
having the two normal ones, I think you're like, that's pretty lucky. Yeah. Okay. Let's go. Yes, let's talk about post-talking. So my question is about how you're doing this rapid fire one. And so you sometimes in science, like things don't work out. And this can be very stressful. I feel like if like in your master's or in your PhD, you're like, something's not working. Mm-hmm. Is it me? Like, how am I going to finish this? So have you noticed a big change in your mindset from once you finish your PhD to how you handle like setbacks or trying to do things? Like, because things are still going to not work out sometimes. But is it as big of a deal once you finish versus before?
So, I mean, ideally, you should know your tolerance for like setbacks mm-hmm. before you start grad school and PhD. PhD is quite an endeavor. So you know, I'm sure we've talked about this a lot on the show, like advice for people, like what you expect in grad school and what you should be ready for.
Yeah.
So nothing ever works like you think it's going to work, you know, and you're going to be like kicked down. Like when you're at your worst, you're going to be like, oh man, it can get worse. Okay. Yeah. So I think I've built up a lot of resilience to that. You hear things. I mean, I remember hearing it in my undergrad from PhDs in labs that I was affiliated with. But I also have heard now people, you hear people say this all the time. They're like, it's just my time. Something goes wrong, just my time. I mean, your time is valuable, but you do get sort of numb to the like, so I did a 2-week long experiment or 6-month experiment. It's ruined. I guess I won't use that data. I'll try and make another figure of, I'll do another different analysis or something. You just kind of go with it. So it's not much different in this case, but I mean, I think one thing, if you hadn't learned it already by grad school, you should know after. So this is one thing you can learn is some people, they are like demoralized by the setbacks in their PhD and they realize that this unpredictability is like not for them.
Yep.
And that's a good idea to just say, hey, maybe staying in academia, maybe staying in research in general, even not outside of academia, isn't for me.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can learn that in your PhD. So what I think I'm quite fortunate to kind of have a strong idea what I want to do for like most of my life. Like my wife always jokes about a home video that I found. I happened to click a video. It was just me sitting in a kitchen at like 10 years old. And my mom goes like, what do you want to be? And like little baby Ariel was like, a scientist. And like, she's like, you've always wanted to do this. I was like, yeah, pretty much. So I've known and I've luckily my temperament has managed to jive with what my interests are as well. So I knew kind of going in that I got to be resilient and I have, you know, there's been a lot of setbacks and a lot of difficulties in this like short postdoc, and I expect there to continue to be like kind of forever. But I don't know. I think I'm thriving. I think I'm doing okay. So I would say if people are concerned about that, then you need to like introspect a lot before you decide which direction you're going to want to go. And you probably want to do that before you finish your PhD so you have an idea. Because you want to, I mean, you might be in a position that you don't need a job right after you're done, but you might want to line something up right before you're actually finished your PhD. So I introspected and considered. I'm still like, doors are open still. I'm trying not to close doors. So I could still go outside of academia and do an industry job or a completely different, I don't know, government, like who knows. I haven't closed any of those doors. But I thought about it quite deeply before I fully committed to like, I want to go to postdoc. I want to do it this way. So I think I'm well set for it and handling it as best as I can. Seriously.
So I'm kind of curious, like you said, you started looking at postdocs fairly early on. Like what is the time frame that you should be looking into postdocs? I have yet to start doing that, and I'm a major planner, so I want to know when I should be doing that.
Okay, well, luckily there's a lot of ways to do it, so like it's not too late to like get on it if you want to. I was recommended early on in my PhD to start like as soon as you can. Okay. So how deeply I looked into it, I wasn't quite all that deep into it, like actually finding the contact information and investigating, emailing people. I wasn't doing any of that until like the last year.
Maybe okay, so just kind of looking into things.
I was just checking where there were like labs doing things I wanted to do. I mean, first you got to narrow down the country, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, you got to narrow down the country, then narrow down the region of the country, and then you have to think of those extraneous factors in your life. Like, then you can kind of decide what you want to do. So, I mean, that might change as well. Mm-hmm. So before I met my partner, I was, you know, interested in still going down, like, the Alzheimer's focus path, and there's a lot of good Alzheimer's research in Germany.
Okay.
But now my wife is a social worker, and she wants to work with children in the language that they speak. So, she, you know, in discussion with her, we agreed to narrow my focus to English-speaking countries. Mm-hmm. And both of us agreed that, like, Australia is, like, treacherous, so, like, screw that. But, so we were, like, kind of, like, basically restricted to the UK. You know, that, so that kind of narrows things down a little bit, and then you can look, right? But you can explore options and see. I mean, if you have something you're interested in, you can look up that topic and see what, like, professors are there. Mm-hmm. But I was, you know, I mean, conferences are for networking, so you can, like, go to make sure you're talking to people and keeping those in mind, and, like, maybe, like, keeping some records of, like, who you're interested in when you talk to people. And if you make a connection, then, like, keep some information about that connection so that if you meet up with them again, you remember it. So I don't know if I did that perfectly well, but I went to a conference in Germany in 2018. It was an the Federation of European Neuroscientists.
Okay.
It's like SFN, and it's like Society for Neuroscience, which is, like, one of the biggest conferences in the world that happens in America. It's like the one in Europe. So I went there to kind of, like, see what kind of European neuroscientists are doing in Alzheimer's field, and, like, in Germany specific. It was great. And that gave me some ideas of actually some professors that are, like, here and whatnot. But, like, obviously things changed, and ended up focusing on the UK and actually on flies, on fruit flies. So, like, kind of everything changed. Anyway, so that's why it was good that I didn't, like, waste too much time, like, delving into it. But what are the main things you want to do when you get down to it? Well, make a list of the professors you would like. And that might include people that you're not sure you'd really actually want to work with, or you're not even really sure they're in the place you want to work with, but you're going to have that list, and then you kind of narrow them down. And then you can, like, cluster them, like, what kind of, like, field they are in, so that when you do more narrow, so now if you decide, you know, I might work with flies, I might want to work with mice, or I might want to work with potatoes. well, if some point you're like, I only want to work with animals, I'm, like, done with doing all this biochemistry with, like, potatoes. You just scratch off the potato list, right? Yeah. So have your stuff organized. So I had, like the mouse people, and I had the fly people, and I had the Alzheimer's people, and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of was like, okay, I'm going to set aside the Alzheimer's people, because I'm going to decide to focus on more basic science questions related to flies. So then I had a short list of that. And then depending on where it is, where the lab is, like, if those labs are around and you have options to, like, be in communication with those people, or go to conferences where they're presenting. You can see if they're giving, like, a keynote or a plenary lecture. Go to them. Like, even, like, find them on YouTube. They might have, like, recorded some of these lectures. Go and investigate those people. So now you're just, like, you're just musing about the idea of these people, right? And that and really important is, if you see video, or you meet them, or see video of somebody giving a presentation, you get a little bit of an idea about their demeanor. And this is something I really want to emphasize, is that we've talked about this on GradCast a lot before, and it's equally important, maybe even more important in your postdoc, that you need to be with somebody that, like, you know, you can build a somewhat good relationship. Yeah. You may be the kind of person that'd be like, okay, I'm going to go and be a cog in the machine in a massive lab, because I'm going to get funded, and I'm probably going to get a big paper, and I'm probably going to be on a lot of papers. But if it, like, takes a toll on your mental health, you may be booted out of academia in general, because you're like, this is just no good for you. And that's not the best. So kind of, like, I try to weave in work-life balance into all of these things. So I'm like, what can I do that's, like, going to further my career but also make me happy and make my wife happy and make my life happy?
Yeah.
So it's like, let's kind of, like, account for all those things. So you're accounting for all those things and just musing about, like, all the cool opportunities that might be out there, and then you list them. And if they're nowhere near here, like, for me, how the hell do you get involved in a UK lab when you're here? It's, like, not super close, and they're not always coming to London, Ontario to speak or something. So honestly, social media is, like, where it was at the time. There was a lot of posts, there's a lot of stuff going on Twitter, and actually the job that I got, he was on my list, this professor, his name's Andrew Lin. he was on my list, my short list of people I was interested in. But then he happened to post a job for a research associate on Twitter.
Oh, nice.
I thought, great, apply.
Yep.
So keep, and that's a good reason why you want to follow those people. Mm-hmm. You're not following because you're like, oh, they had a good bike ride and they saw the sunset. The eclipse was dope, but it hurt their eyes. See, you don't following for that reason. Yeah. You know, just look out for those job opportunities. Maybe even follow the institutions you're interested mm-hmm. in or the group within an institution. Yeah. So there might be like the entomology society for mm-hmm. some group, or the potato researcher society, or whatever. I don't know. Vaccine research group, whatever it is. You find that those groups and follow them on their social media. I'm saying social media, although at the time it was totally Twitter, and there's a lot going on. Science and academic Twitter is like a big thing. A lot of job opportunities on there. There's actually accounts that are specifically for posting jobs. You can follow them too. And you can go to the society websites and look for jobs as well. But you may find, and more often than not, unless you get lucky like I did and found like that they somebody you're interested posted a job, mm-hmm. you're just gonna have to contact them once you've narrowed down the list to a short list mm-hmm. and contact. Like I contacted like a dozen people maybe or something,
yeah.
and like interviewed like 3 or 4 different labs. Ended up actually like meeting with them and stuff on Zoom because it was they're not here.
Yeah.
So you want to you narrow down your focus slowly but surely, and that's how you want to do it. But I will shout out that like there's another social media, Blue Sky, that I'm finding is slowly becoming better suited for science. So maybe check out multiple social medias. Twitter mm-hmm. is still decent for this purpose, so I'd mm-hmm. say like indispensable. Go there; mm-hmm. it's where a lot of stuff is happening. But couldn't hurt to get involved in some other social media too. Blue Sky is one of them.
Okay. Do you feel like you have a, quote, real job?
Yes. So the reason I'm not actually doing much different science, like mm-hmm. my day-to-day is like pretty similar. But it's the little things.
Yeah.
You're like, when you like even do your like health stuff, it's like through your health plan is through like, and your income is like all like kind of through administrative things that is a job and not like being treated like a student.
Yeah.
We kind of infantilize like PhDs a little bit. Mm-hmm. Maybe some PhDs are, it's maybe more appropriate than others, I'm not sure, but like a lot of PhDs are just doing like straight up work, so like they should be partitioned. And you know, like the TA union is doing like a whole thing right now and in position to strike and all that, and like certainly that's things that workers should need to be involved in. So PhDs feel like workers already in some respects. So to that same degree, I still feel like a worker, still doing that same work. I just feel like now it's not, there's nobody in any position that's actually looking at me and being like, oh, they're a student. Like it's never getting that that slight passive mm-hmm. infant whatever.
Yeah,
not being treated like a student anymore. Mm-hmm. On the other hand as well, you're not always doing it, and some people are like not that close with their advisory committee, and they don't meet with them all that much, and they might even have a supervisor that's not even in town a lot, so like, they're not always seeing people, like meeting with them and getting progress reports. Like the labs, research groups, regardless of whether like a lab in science or otherwise, function a lot differently depending on who the mm-hmm. supervisor is and who the student is. But as a postdoc, regardless, you don't have a committee of people who are like looking out for you and advising you. I mean, you might still have your mentors, and I still go to my mm-hmm. mentors. I think I leverage those connections with people that that are senior to me in career to get advice from them. So I wouldn't bat an eye at like going to any of those advisors for more advice, and I would like to actually do that as much as I need to, but you don't actually report to anybody in that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You still sort of report to your supervisor, and that's going to depend on the group that you're in, but because you don't have that like kind of looming deadlines and classes and having to check like what are my grades and transcripts, you're not really doing any of that student-y stuff, so mm-hmm. it's out of mind. even though you were never really thinking about it on 100% of the time anyway, it's out of mind now, so you do feel like an actual person. But the number one thing, an actual working person, should I say.
Yes, yeah.
The number one thing is at the end of the month or the semester, when you're getting your pay or you're doing your budgeting and you don't have tuition.
Yes.
Factored in there. That is, tuition is like it's a ball and chain. Yeah. I mean, we understand that the reason for tuition, although there's an argument to be made that there might be some systemic thing that can happen where you can get certainly a bachelor's for free, depending on what government you're at, but that's a much bigger question. But not having to deal with the tuition piece is, that's the number one thing. You're not thinking about that tuition thing anymore, and now you're like not feeling like a student
extra
anymore.
Money.
Yeah, well, it's not that much extra money. Pay most folks don't get paid much. If you got a Vanier and then you got my postdoc position, that you would be taking a pay cut.
Oh.
You'd be taking a pay cut to do my job. So.
So you mean, so Vanier is a PhD scholarship.
Vanier is the highest PhD scholarship. In fact, you could get a Vanier and like a J&J, you can get like private scholarships, and then you get government Vanier's from the Canadian government.
Yeah.
Like, it's very rare. I've only ever heard and never met the person, but I heard of somebody who got a Vanier, 50 grand, maybe a little bit more now, mm-hmm. plus another large private scholarship that was also 50 grand.
Wow.
They're making 100. They're making more than some professors make on their start.
Wow.
So that's unusual. But what I'm trying to say is Vanier is like the standard for a high, like our best candidates. They get their Vanier. That's like the number one government scholarship you can get. If you're getting that, you're getting paid more than what I'm getting paid right now as a postdoc. Okay. So yes, you're getting paid for sure. Like, I feel like I went from barely climbing to not be in the red to like sort of just managing to stay not in the red, and not like, I'm not like building wealth here. So am I slightly more comfortable? Yeah, I'm okay. I mean, in my case, I'm like having to budget for like a transatlantic move, which is like quite costly. Mm-hmm. So it's like I don't feel like any much less financial pressure, but just not seeing the tuition thing is like definitely a relief.
The little victories.
Yes.
On kind of the topic of like finances, do you ever feel like stressed that you chose this route, and that like maybe if you compare yourself to like your peers that have been in a career for some years now, like do you ever feel behind? Like I struggled with this myself like last year. I was like, oh my god, like if I would have done this differently, I could have been making so much more money. Like do you ever think about stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, not to like kind of punt this, but again to a systemic issue and not an interpersonal issue, but I think I have to acknowledge the position that I'm in. Mm-hmm. And that position is, hey, my parents paid for my undergrad.
Yes.
I didn't come into this in debt. And a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. A lot of people come in with a massive amount of debt. And it's quite a shame. I really think there would be some like awesome researchers out there who are like missing massive opportunities for financial reasons. So, like that's quite a shame. And it weighs on me. But I'm in quite a privileged situation that I can focus on what I care about at the cost of my financial well-being. Mm-hmm. So I know that if I was absolutely screwed, you know, I could like live in my parents' basement for a little bit and get a job back at the liquor store that if I were to stay at that job and continue to maintain my seniority, I'd be making more than I'm making now at that job. Mm-hmm. So like I could go back to that. Not that I'm would get back to that. I'm not planning on doing any of that, but I have like these options and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'm able to not have to factor that into my calculation all that much. And I wish that everybody could. Mm-hmm. I really wish that everybody could. But the reality is that it is a lot of financial pressure to go into academia, especially if you want to, like I'm going to the UK because I want to get a breadth of experience that I can leverage to come back here. So it's going to be even more costly than to come back, right? Like, so there's a lot of costs that I'm planning to incur in my life with the knowledge that I'm like mostly going to be okay to do it. And it does weigh on me that it's going to be difficult, but it weighs on me more that I think I'm going to manage, but others won't.
Yeah.
That's actually more of a concern to me. Not that I'm like doing any big thing to change anything systematically. So what can I say to people who are like like in a difficult situation? Let's say you were in exactly the same position as me, except you're sitting with a $30,000 in debt. unfortunately, like, I caveated that with all the concern that I actually do have for this situation. But unfortunately, people will have to make that calculation and decide whether mm-hmm. it is a lifestyle they can take on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I do not blame people. Like, I blame a system, mm-hmm. broken system. I do not blame individuals for going, I can't afford to go into academia. This mm-hmm. is absurd. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be like booted. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be totally screwed if I do this. Like, what if you want kids? I don't have kids. What if you want kids? What if you want multiple kids? Like, come on. Like, are you going to like be like, oh, I'm going to go into academia and maybe I'll have enough money by the time I'm in my mid 40s to have a kid. And then maybe I'll have one if I can like biologically still do it. If that's the cost you're taking, but you really care about like having kids and stuff, mm-hmm. and you know, the science is like, it's kind of a cool career, but it's not something you've been like thinking about your whole life, and mm-hmm. you're not willing to sacrifice, making mm-hmm. a massive, massive sacrifice, then I don't blame you. Don't do it. Don't do it. Mm-hmm. Do not do that. Like, care about your well-being when you're going to do that. And I get it. Like, if people are going to be in that situation. So there are ways to do it. Like, if you still do care, like, try and work your hardest to get postdoc fellowships. Like, there's bursaries, there's mm-hmm. Probably also support. Like, these government educational institutions have a lot of supports mm-hmm. for people who lack funds in certain ways. Mm-hmm. So when you get involved in an institution, then like explore those options. Mm-hmm. Go to HR, go to the admin there and talk to people about getting that support. So maybe you can make it work, but I do not blame anybody who goes and decides, this isn't for me for the monetary reason. And mm-hmm. it is a big stressor when it comes to academia.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was going to ask, maybe you can just talk briefly, because you talked about it a bit before, but how do you defend your work-life balance and not feel like you're getting sucked into the hole of mm. postdoc life?
I think this is something that I spoke about last time I was on, my last one of my PhD. I'm not sure if I mentioned this at all, but it's kind of like a little bit of my life philosophy in general, and I think it kind of helps. I mean, maybe I'm biased because it's working for me, but maybe it doesn't work for anyone else. So take everything I say with a grain of salt, but here's my two cents. It's kind of a sprinkle of stoicism on top of, I don't know, realism, if you want to say that. Mm-hmm. I do my best in everything that I do, everything, not just science, mm-hmm. To lower my expectations, don't have super high expectations, but still have ideals that I strive for, very high ideals. I like, you know, if you're in science and you think like, what's the biggest thing you can do? People will be like, well,
Nobel
like,
Prize. Yeah, cure Nobel. Cancer.
Exactly. So, right. These are things you might strive for. That's fine. If you want to strive for those, that's fine. But don't expect it. Right. Do not expect it. Don't have those expectations, because I mean, you can kind of learn this in neuroscience as well, but like, I just feel like it feels much worse to have expectations not met. Mm-hmm. Than it does. Well, what's the comparison? Expectations not met than to like
have like unexpectedly success.
Unexpected success, I suppose. Yeah, I guess. So I try to taper my expectations massively, and that's where does this tie into my work-life balance? Well, if my expectations for my productivity are a bit lower, then when I do the things that I've like assessed are like rationally are the things that I need to do to have a work-life balance, which means like, you know, like you're not like working all the time. Like, even if you go home at 6 p.m., you're like, eat dinner. You don't have to like go and read all the papers, or like you can prep for that experiment tomorrow. It'd be nice to have pre-prepared your experiment so you can just hit the ground running at 9 a.m. but maybe just take a few hours extra tomorrow to do it, and maybe even take a whole day to prep your experiment so you can do the experiment 2 days. Now you've lost a day, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. That's okay. Like, just do your best to make sure like everything you're doing is like rigorous and thorough and well documented. I think that holds for anybody doing any PhD or any research. But don't have like some sort of like crazy expectation for the things you're gonna output, mm-hmm. And I think that's the best thing that helps in my brain. Is it gonna actually leading to like a better outcome? I don't know, mm-hmm. But that is my number one advice.
I should try that. That's much more positive than my expect the worst. So if it happens, you won't be disappointed.
Yeah, don't lower your expectations too low. I know. I didn't warn about that. If you lower expectations way way too low, then it's kind of even hard to see the point of doing anything. You want a little bit of. A little something.
Yeah. for sure. Well, we are approaching the end of the interview. So you talked a bit about social media, but where can our listeners find you on social media if they want to follow your career or ask you a question?
I was like, where could you? So I use social media really for the purposes that I outlined here. Like, yep. I'm mostly just there for like networking, checking out job stuff, and now, like, you know, trying to keep up to date with like papers and stuff. So someone you know posts a paper that is of interest to you, then you can be the first one to like hear about it and read it like very quickly. So if people are hoping to engage with me or get comments on things, I don't do that.
You just lurk.
No. There are very few times where I've actually had like a back and forth discussion about science on social media, but it's like few and far between. It's not the reason that I'm there. So that caveat aside, you can still find me there because it's important to have that presence and it's going to help you with your career. I mean, like if people want to talk to me about planning for their postdoc, even organizational stuff. I was thinking about doing a little tutorial on like how to do social media, how to manage your email, how to do
smart.
All those sorts of little things, even how to keep up to date on the literature. Like I do like NCBI alerts and stuff, and some people don't know how to do that. Yep. So all this sort of organizational admin stuff that people get like their, you know, aneurysms over, I know how to do really well, and I'd happy to help like kind of advise people if they want advice on it. And where you can find me on social media is Ariel Frame everywhere.
Okay.
It's Ariel Frame on Twitter, it's Ariel Frame on Mastodon, it's Ariel Frame on Blue Sky, it's Ariel Frame on Instagram, but don't go there. The only thing I've posted is like back when I was like before PhD and like in between. I think I only posted like beer. So that's like not a thing. But Blue Sky is cool and I like to keep up to date on there, and Twitter is also still chugging along. Okay, so you can get Ariel Frame on both of those.
I think you win the prize for the longest answer to where can we find you on social media.
Definitely.
Yeah, I also, I've lingered. I've been hanging on to GradCast. I don't want to let you go.
I know.
We're cutting you off.
We're cutting you off. Thank you so much for returning to talk to us on Postdocs Talk. It's been a pleasure to hear your voice again on GradCast. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for having me.
It's been great speaking with you.
This has been GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. I've been your host, Emily Hutchinson, and my co-host was Carly Sharon. We've been speaking with Ariel Frame on our hashtag Postdocs Talk miniseries. This episode was produced by me, Emily Hutchinson. If you'd like to be involved with the show or get in contact with us, we have social media. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at GradCast Radio and TikTok now. To listen to us, we're on Radio Western 94.9 FM on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You can find all of our episodes wherever you find your podcasts, and you can send us an email at gradcast@sogs.ca. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day.